Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Welcome everyone, and Shabbat Shalom, Chag Sameach, Happy Hanukkah. You are troopers making it through our long service today. I will try to keep my remarks brief, but it's Hanukkah, and Hanukkah is a really cool time. And what I like to do on the Shabbat of Hanukkah is to remind us of the Hanukkah story and just to draw out a few lessons for us today about the real Hanukkah story that we have. Now, you guys know the children's book story and sort of the legend story, if you will. We prayed the passage in the Amidah that it told about the, you know, the evil Greeks who had taken over the temple and were persecuting the Jews. And Judah Maccabee comes and he leads a rebellion against the Greeks and starts this war and is mighty and strong and defeats the Greeks. The Greeks leave, they come in, the temple is in disarray, and they light the menorah with one day's supply of oil that lasts for 8 days. And we have this story of Hanukkah. It's really important, I think, as we look through where the story comes from and all these things, that the real Hanukkah story is found in the book of Maccabees, and it's a bit different than the one that we tell in the children's books, or add some different insights into it. And I think that's important for us to think about in the process, because it brings out other lessons that we might not think about otherwise. What we don't often hear is that in the second century BCE, when this took place, that these evil Greeks were actually the creators of the most developed civilization that that part of the world has ever known. And I think that's really important that we see that art and archaeology and poetry and history flourish, philosophy and science. These are all things that like came out of this period from the Greeks. And Hellenistic society that we have was modern. And I think that's an important word. It tore down barriers between people. They tried to transcend cultural differences. They were a melting pot. You've heard that term before. They were seeking universalism. They were progressive in their time, for their day. And the expanding Greek culture, it was the center of the world. They had values and ideas and all these things. So what happened was Hellenistic cities were established in the land of Israel, and then a new Greek-speaking, culturally Hellenistic Jewish religion emerged and came out of this experience. The real Hanukkah story is actually a civil war. It's a divide within Jewish people. It's a time when basically Jews felt that if they could modernize and they could assimilate into the wider Greek culture, A, they wouldn't be persecuted anymore, which we've heard before, and B, they would be part of where the world is going. You know, leave these ancient relics of the past and let's move into the future. Of course, second century BCE from our side. But Jewish ways were outdated, and there were groups of Jews that came up that favored aggressive assimilation. And the book of Maccabees actually shares that there were groups of Jews who submitted themselves to uncircumcision, a painful operation to remove the marks of circumcision. I don't know what that looks like. Don't try to imagine it. But they wanted to repudiate the covenant that they had made, that God had made with our people. So others now didn't just not want to be Jewish. Others wanted to be Jewish, but in a Hellenized, non-intrusive, and assimilated way. In other words, to be Jewish, but not in a way that makes us stand out from everyone else. And we can understand this in America today, can't we? The Hanukkah story continues predictably. This is like the history of our people. Antiochus III dies. Antiochus IV comes into power. The comfortable, assimilated life comes to an end. Antiochus moves to, in his words, purify Judaism. In other words, death to all Jews who do not cease from observing the outdated Jewish religion. Now, a statue of Zeus is erected in the temple. Pigs are symbolically offered on the temple. The thing is that Antiochus was not trying to impose his own faith. He was trying to universalize and modernize Judaism for us. He was pluralistic, and he thought that he was saving the Jews from religious relics of the past. He saw himself as a hero, as did many of the Jews in that day. So the resistance came from the least sophisticated, from the country people, from Jewish people, farmers. And these are people that didn't mix with the Greeks and weren't influenced in the same way. And so the battle that happened wasn't just between Jews and Greeks. It was a battle between the Jews. And in 167 BCE, a priest named Mattathias Maccabee got up, and he was fed up, and he stabbed a Jew who sacrificed a pig on the altar. That's not in the children's books that way. He fled with his sons to the hills, gathered a small group of followers, and in the wake of his father's death, Judah Maccabee takes over, and he launches a three-year-long kind of guerrilla warfare campaign against the Greeks and the Hellenized Jews. Now, the politics here were very complicated, as they usually are, but it wasn't really that the Maccabees got so strong that they kicked the Greeks out. It was more that the king decided that they'd caused enough of a ruckus and he had other business elsewhere, and he pulled his armies out and gave, you know, us control over the temple again. However, the Jewish priesthood was so assimilated and Hellenized and still funded by the Greek government that they left the statue of Zeus in the temple. And remember, that priesthood had funded the festival of Hercules. The temple had become like a Greek-Jewish relations center of some kind. So Judah Maccabee regathered his followers once again, struck Jerusalem, but this time driving that Jewish Hellenized priesthood out of the temple. And then on the 25th of Kislev, they rededicated the temple, and the eight-day event that they created to dedicate this was modeled after Sukkot, and the light of the menorah symbolizing God's presence. And then we find this enduring tradition recorded in the Mishnah, which is around 3rd century, that holds that this miracle took place, that one day's oil lasted for the entire 8 days. We're left to wonder and to decide what happened and how all that comes together. But if we look at that story, you know, we celebrate these 8 days that really have nothing to do with Jewish Christmas and have a whole different story behind them. What are some of the lessons that we can pull out of the Hanukkah flame for us today as we light our Hanukkiah? The menorah is enduring light. It's an enduring light that doesn't burn out. That's the whole idea of the menorah in the temple. Now, there's this idea that every Jewish soul is like a light, like the Shamash candle in the menorah as it passes its light to others. And that's the Jewish community. This is a light that we've been given, and we've been given it to pass on to others, to share from generation to generation, l'dor v'dor, to bring light into the broken world, to be a blessing to the nations. That's the Jewish call. But as the Jewish people assimilate, the teaching goes, we become less and less Jewish, and the light becomes dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And so I've shared these statistics before, but I think they're really helpful to kind of keep in mind as we move forward from the 2013 Pew study, and I did look up to see if there was another one, but I think they do them every 10 years, so we'll get the new ones in a few years. But as of that study, the Jewish population made up less than 0.2% of the world's population. In the mainstream secular Jewish community, the average birth rate is about 1.29 per family, and the assimilation rate is 49%. So at this rate, out of every 100 Jews in our generation, there will be 41 Jews in the second generation, 17 Jews in the third generation, 7 Jews left in the fourth generation. And then the Reform Jewish stats rival that with the remaining 10 Jews after 4 generations. So we look at those stats and we go, oh, and this is what the Jewish community has done over the past few years because of this study. And it's fun, it started a lot of initiatives because of the study. Now, I think what's going on is Satan is doing everything in his power to diminish the light that we've been called to carry. And more insidious than genocide, as horrible as that is Satan coming in from the inside and ever so gradually helping Jews to no longer want to be Jews anymore. We look at these statistics. The birth rate is one issue that people talk about. Our family is helping with that in the old-fashioned way. Wink, wink. Interestingly, the Pew study showed that the more connected individual people were to Jewish community, the earlier they married, the more children they had, and the more that those children would grow up to identify as Jewish, just the stats. And the opposite is also true. Now, the Orthodox sway these stats a little bit because their birth rate is dramatically higher. It's like 4 times higher than the other communities because they have this value of larger family in order to build their community. That's the purpose. But it's counterbalanced by the high defecting rate of Orthodox children. So they still make up only 10%. If all of those Jewish Orthodox children stayed Orthodox, they would be over 50% by now. So we know that there's a high defecting rate within the Orthodox community who are also growing up, leaving the community and assimilating. The second phenomenon that's often blamed is intermarriage. Because of the stats, the rate of intermarriage for non-Orthodox Jews is 72%, 79% for secular Jews, a little bit higher. Now, in-married Jews, this is the reason why people have blamed intermarriage, that in-married Jews, Jews and Jews, are 96% more likely to raise their children as Jews, but only 20% of intermarried couples said they were raising active Jewish children. So the Jewish community, you know, back then said, well, we need to go against intermarriage because this is what's happening, we're dying. But recently there's a new trend that's happening in the Jewish community where Jewish thinkers and community shapers are wondering whether the issue is intermarriage itself or something different. And the Jewish community is beginning to actually embrace the idea of intermarriage as an opportunity rather than a threat. So they argue that intermarried families can intentionally raise Jewish children. And as more and more of the Jewish world embraces a wider view of Jewish identity to include paternal descent, which is a move that's, I think, inescapable in the Jewish world and is moving slowly. Of course, the Reform is there, our community is already there, and I believe we'll see the conservative movement there soon as well. As they move to embrace this reality with the intermarried stats as they have, that will make a significant impact on our future as a Jewish community, wouldn't it? Interestingly, it seems that today, more and more children of intermarried parents seem to be choosing to identify as Jews as adults, even if they weren't raised that way, kind of going against the stats. So there's a little bit of hope that some Jews are kind of seeing that we're not totally dying. But fighting assimilation is very nuanced and it's very complicated. I mean, just think about it in our lives, all the different forces that were pulled from so many different angles. And so I'm not suggesting and standing up here saying that we should be Hanukkah zealots with pitchforks and swords. I think if a Maccabee were to walk in this room, we wouldn't get along all that well, necessarily. But I think it isn't that there's one Jewish ideal, you know, one kind of traditional Jew that out-Jews all the other Jews. I'm a modern Jew, where we all are. Going back to the shtetl is not an option for me. It's not ideal. The Jewish world today is dramatically changing, like it has in other times in our history. I've heard it said that the Jewish world today is going through as much of a change as it did in the exile when the temple was destroyed and then we were sent off. Back in the land, but not really, but with all this political turmoil and where we're at now, everything is getting reshaped and it's all going to look different. So what assimilation does is it isolates Jews from his or her community, from their communities. That's what assimilation does. And that's why those stats show that Jewish children raised in actively Jewish community, they show that if Jewish children experience Jewish education, teenagers experience Jewish summer camps and those kinds of experiences, college groups, the stats show that we'll have more and more of those children who will then pass on this Jewish torch. So education and community is a huge part of this fighting assimilation. And conversely, those Jews who assimilate and remove themselves from Jewish community, from Jewish life, and from education experiences, it's interesting. They, according to the stats, tend not to marry at all, or marry later, or have less children, and in the words of Brandeis professor Sylvia Fishman, be much less likely to produce children who will strongly be connected Jewishly tomorrow. So the lesson of the enduring flame of Hanukkah for today that I'm bringing out is about passion. It's about passion for Jewish identity, passion for being and living Jewish, passion for our God-given Jewish call that we have. And even more specifically, it's about passion for our Jewish community, the place where we relight our own menorah and then help other people to light their menorot, if you will, and then pass the flame of the menorah down from generation to generation, Lador Vador, onward. And I'm not only speaking to families with kids. Jewish community is so much bigger. It all fits in together. So whether you're younger or older or single or married, we're all integral parts of an intergenerational Jewish community. And you all play your role and you all pass on the torch. Of course, there are those of you, you know, here who are not Jewish among us, who are intimately connected to us through the Messiah, who are here because of marriage or here because of a passion to come alongside and build the Jewish people because you've seen the need to carry on the torch to the next generation. in the Jewish community. And if it weren't for you, Rock Israel wouldn't be here. And it's an amazing thing. So we celebrate you as well. And you're a part of this whole experience. Now, what makes Messianic Jewish Jews different from other Jews is that, you know, of course, we follow, you know, the greatest Jew who ever lived. And I would think that that might make for us, at least in terms of passion and commitment, more like a Maccabee than a Hellenized Universalist. At least in terms of passion. And our passion for Yeshua drives our passion for being Jewish, and our passion for being Jewish drives our passion for Yeshua, because he's our Jewish heartbeat. He's right at the center. He's our passion. We can't remove the head from the body. You know, you can't take the heart out from, you know. So Yeshua is the Jewish experience. He is the center of the Jewish experience, and ultimately there's no Judaism apart from him. You know, we can't separate those things. And if you think about it, I think that Messianic Jews, one day we should have the lowest assimilation rates. Maybe by the next study, maybe we'll be included in it one day. But of course, there's a lot of history that we're up against here. And because of the history that other Jews have seen us as a threat to the Jewish community, because of that history, they've seen us as a doorway out of Jewish life. They've seen Yeshua as a doorway out rather than a doorway in. We've talked about that a lot. But it isn't supposed to be that way. And in a way, I think the beginnings of the modern Messianic Jewish movement, where Yeshua seems to find those of us who were astray in some way from the Jewish community and bring us home. How many of you here were more astray from the Jewish community, more assimilated than you are today after meeting Yeshua and after coming to faith in him? You know, that's my story. That's a number of people's stories. Yeshua is leading sort of a Baal Teshuva movement, starting from the outside in. Because what happens for us is that once we know Yeshua, once we know our shamash, if you will, the light of the world in our soul, and once he lights our soul, then we rediscover our menorah. We rediscover our Jewish soul. And then we have to hold on and fight for both. So we need to be Maccabees for Yeshua as Jews, you know. And we need to stand with him and our Jewish identity. I'm taking a really interesting class at Hebrew College Me'ah program on Jewish-Christian relations. And at the beginning of the class, I wanted to be totally upfront about who I was and in this dynamic. So I raised my hand and we were kind of just talking and discussion and whatever. I just said, I want everyone to know that I'm probably the most controversial Jew in the room. I'm a Messianic Jew. I explained what that means and what it doesn't mean. And I'd like for you to see me in the Jewish-Christian discussion on the Jewish side of the table, you know? And it's amazing. I've been totally accepted and welcomed and a part of the discussion and asked questions and everything. It's been a really great experience. But I've made a few friends too. And one woman in particular has been very explicit with me and straightforward. And she comes up and we talk for usually an hour after class. In the beginning, she said to me, "My problem with you," she said, "is that I'm threatened by you. I'm afraid of you. I have devoted," she's in her probably early 70s, "I've devoted my entire life," she said, "to Jewish education and to building up the next generation of the Jewish community, and you threaten that. And I wish you could just choose. Just be one or the other, you know, right?" And I said to her, "I understand how you feel, and I get it. I totally get it, because I want to see Jewish grandchildren too." And it was a really great moment for both of us because we were able to start connecting and talking about Jewish life and all kinds of things in the Jewish community. And it started this relationship where we were kind of like on the same page. And just last week, she came up to me and we were talking and she's like, "You know, I want you to know, I've been telling everyone in my community, in my Jewish community, about the Messianic Jew in my class." And she's like, "And he's kind of nice." And she was telling me how she's starting to kind of reshape her stereotypes and her picture of what we're about. And I've shared with her about our kind of Messianic Jewish mission in a way that we have, that in a Jewish world that is of the most diverse and accepting and embracing of different kinds of Jews, you know, we're often pushed to the back of the bus. And we're starting to go there, and it's fun. I want to also mention Diane, I think you're a modern Messianic Maccabee right here. You got to get your sword on, right? Your sword is your emails. So Diane's most recent battle has been communication with the PJ Library. You know PJ Library? Did you know that in their FAQ section, they actually have a statement that says, "We do not allow Messianic Jews to receive our books." We receive their books, And I'm okay with that. So we're going to keep receiving their books, but they actually have it on there. Isn't that amazing? And so when we saw that, Diane was like, I'm writing them right now. So she wrote a series of beautiful emails that were really wonderful. And the basic, if I get it right, the basic response has been, you've given us a lot to think about. We haven't really thought about these things ever before, but all of our donors have this policy and there's nothing we can do about it. But our website is free. You can use our website. You know, like that's basically it. We may have lost this battle for now, but you've advanced the greater cause, you know. Anyway, this Hanukkah, let us remember who we are and who we're called to be. We're in the midst of a great awakening in the body of Messiah, and I really think that the Messianic Jewish movement is like we've used the phrase, tip of the spear, you know. And I think we need to be passionate about this. We're the first in modern history to hold these two flames together, nurturing the light that every Jew has within and the light of Messiah, the light of the world. We read in Yochanan today as Yeshua goes and sees the great menorah in Jerusalem. He says, I am the light of the world, you know. And we hold these two things together so that we have passion for both without separating the two. And it's not that we have the Jewish side and the Yeshua side. It's, again, they're integrated together. You think of the Havdalah candle that comes together and is interwoven. And that reminds me of another neat picture from Camp World Adore that I like to share every so often. It was a few years ago, but we were at our host camp in New York, and our group, our Messianic Jewish camp of maybe 40 people total, was in the middle. And the host camp, not Messianic Jewish camp, had about 200 kids and their staff all surrounding us in this big circle. And we started the Havdalah ceremony with their rabbi, Rabbi Claire, holding her Havdalah candle and me holding our Havdalah candle together. And we held them up like this as one in the whole circle going out. Like, it's just a beautiful picture. Yeah, you were there, Diane. Just an amazing experience. You know, I really think we're making history here. And the center of it is Jewish community. The center of it is our Jewish community and our Messianic Jewish community here. So tonight, as you gather around to light the seventh light, hold fast to your light inside. Treasure our Messianic Jewish community. Treasure the light of the menorah that endures within it, within us. And then let your heart burn for Yeshua's Jewish. So with that, Shabbat Shalom, Chag Sameach.
Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of the Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of the Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those. Messiah.